Boom! Happy holiday, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Giving Flowers 2. This week is special once again. You already know we're having legends on, an unsung pioneer of the freeski culture. His extensive contribution to the community is manifold, from the first X Games gold medal in freestyle skiing, the first X Games gold medal, founder of the notorious Cyber Cartel brand, which most of y'all are probably familiar with, but you'll learn more about it. He organized radical events, put youths on a pedestal. One of skiing's most influential brand leader, X Games gold medalist, brand strategist, elite human being. Welcome, everybody, to Mike Nick. Happy 420, people. We're going to get Iverg and Mike Nick on here in a second. Thanks for joining. And hope all amazingly today.
Happy holidays, buddy.
Happy holiday, Rick.
Man, I'm so blue. I should have been green today. Next week.
Ooh, you styling out, man.
It's Mike Nick's song. We're in Mike Nick's song. How stoked are we?
Mike Nick, we're beyond stoked, man. You know who we got on today. Special. You made him even more special by giving him the ender of Stereotype, one of Iberg's famously acclaimed movies.
Yeah, there's so many shots in that is Stereotype segment probably 20 years ago exactly today. Fucking awesome. Mike Nick.
Legendary.
Too difficult, boys. Too difficult. No one said phones only.
Yeah, I knew you had the wrong answer. How old are you nowadays?
Just turned 46 on Monday, bro.
No way. You gotta be.
Yeah, for real. Tax day, the 15th. 15th of April here in America, tax day is a shitty day.
Happy birthday a couple days late. Hey,
who said cell phones only, Phil? Nobody did.
Nobody did. No, but now we know.
Now we know.
Who goes on Instagram on their computer, Mike?
Old people.
The audio. Yeah. And the screen is bigger. It's so much better. I don't know. I'm old, man. I use my computer.
I had to learn, Mike. I was old too, but then I had to become young in order to learn it.
Yeah. And see, now you can't even make this loud enough. Like, I gotta turn up my hearing aids. What's up, boys?
All right, people, listen. Phil, we got him on
that opening,
the legendary.
It's like the hype reel to a Mike Tyson fight. It's awesome.
Yes, sir. Stop biting. Yeah, Mike. Yeah. So good to see you, man. So good to have you on.
Yeah, but hey, before we start, Iverg, did you know that I had put in a different request for the track on that edit? Do you remember what it was?
For Mike Tyson? Or the most... Oh, the most deaf one. Felix edited something different. So I know. Yeah, it was like a party, and it was fucking awesome. And I had a producer... And the only opinion he had in 6 days of me making that whole movie there was, you're going to get sued if you use that. And I know. So, yes, I totally remember that we changed your song.
Yeah, but do you know what it was? It was supposed to be Burning Down the House by the Talking Heads. It would have been awesome.
It's a doper version than the most deaf one. But when I watched it, I was still stoked. And I was so stoked when I saw the picture from the Cork 7 at Mount Hood parking lot. And you know, it might have been 20 years to this date. 20 years ago today, Cork 7.
It was like 20 years ago that came out, or was being filmed?
Being filmed. Came out in the fall time, man. We were probably Mount Hood last week of April. You saw how dirty it was.
Yeah. I almost hit a tree on one of those runouts, too. There was a tree, like, dead center, like, lined up with that jump. Way down the hill, man. I remember almost hitting that thing. That would have sucked.
Yeah, the trees were sticky.
What's up, boys? Phil, how you doing?
Yes, sir. Oh, I'm doing great, man. So nice to have you on. Yeah. It's been too long.
I know.
Dude, getting lost and overwhelmed by all that you did on your website and online, man. If anybody wants to go on Mike Nick website, don't do it. You'll feel bad about the little that you've done in life compared to this man right here.
Really? So that's where all the investigative reporting took place, huh, on that website?
And YouTube, New Schoolers. New Schoolers got some nice little undug gems hidden.
I think that website's got to get updated. I made that website. I've never had a job interview. I never had to put a resume together. So I was like, I feel like I'm the only guy on the planet has never had a resume. So I built the website to like kind of encapsulate the stories.
It's better than a Wikipedia or whatever. What do people use? I don't even know. I made a LinkedIn page. And I just wrote shit down.
Yeah, these LinkedIn. I don't really have one of those either. I'm surprised you found stuff, man, because I don't have a big online presence, unlike you, Bill.
Oh man, so you'd be surprised.
Yeah,
yeah. Let's go back and start from the beginning.
I want to wait, Phil. Oh. Mike, do you know why we do this? To fill you in, like why we do it live and what the whole point of this is.
Well, no, he didn't tell me much. He just said, hey, do you want to have a conversation next week? And then he said, just go on Instagram. I said, okay. All right, well.
So what the point of this is we want to create a place where we celebrate the people that helped create the sport, the people that brought something that's awesome to the sport. So we've already done Julien Renier Laforge. We've done Michel Dittino. And so pretty much this is pretty much Phil and I want to sit down and pretty much pat you on the back and give you your flowers and say thank you. So it's not really an interview. It's nothing more than the others celebrate everything that you did for the sport. And when I was making the list with Phil, like, you're at the top of people that, like, a lot of people don't know what you did. And so it's pretty crazy. And I'm a history freak in our sport. And we all helped create the history in the sport. So it's like, we just want to use this as a platform to say how dope you are. So it's not an interview. It's kind of just to go through, high five you, say, this is what you did, man. It's official. It's real. Fucking that's who Mike Nick is. If you didn't know, now you know.
So that's very, and coming from you guys who are legends in your own, one more current maybe than the other. I don't want to, you know, insult you by that, but I mean, Phil is still alive and kicking in a big way. So,
well, that's why we're hosting it. We're using Phil's platform to make sure we can fucking tell all the people that are right. Current where they came from.
That's a smart way to do it.
Thanks, man. We're so glad that you came on. And thanks to Iberg for implementing that idea, because that came from Iberg in the first place. And Iberg's extent of knowledge of the free ski culture is unmatched. So we got you on.
So Phil, like, you and Henrik are always going back into the books and like looking at stuff that's happened and finding ways to incorporate it into what you're doing now. So don't slight yourself on being a historian, buddy, because I think you are one. As far as a skier athlete is concerned, like, you cross eras, which is pretty amazing.
Thank you so much, man.
He's like got 17 years as a professional skier.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty intense. So, but I think what you guys are doing with this is sort of like what Chad Muska did with Ether. You guys have seen those, I'm sure, right?
I stole the whole idea from Drink Champs.
I don't know what that one is.
But it's pretty much the dopest podcast where they just sit down with rap legends and they just like, dude, we're giving you the flowers. You can go fucking watch Luke. You can watch like E-40. Name your favorite rapper from any generation. It's just a 2-hour celebration of how dope they are. So I said, we need to do that and ski him.
Yeah, I don't know if it was Chad Muska that did the whole series, but I think it's on Vice. It's on Vice. They go back and they talk to like, I don't know, just like old skateboard dudes, snowboard dudes from way back in the day, and they do these like, you know, what are they doing now type things. It's pretty awesome. So
it's called Epically Latered. Vice. Yeah. Check it out. Yeah, no, I love that show.
Right. Yeah, but I said, but I don't know who put it on. I don't know if it was Chad who like produces it, or was he just one guy that starred?
I think they just had a piece on him that was epic, and then Vice produced everything. Someone.
Yeah. Good series. Feel you like it a lot.
Yeah, I follow that. You know it.
Ah, cool. All right.
Digging deep. Yeah, definitely an inspiration for this. And yeah, so people get a bit more of aware of where you started, how you started. So when was it that J-Lev and you were in your father's garage and J-Lev used your father's arc welder to press ski boards? What year were we then?
It's probably, well, Line started officially in 1995, so I don't know. It could have been like 93-ish, 93, 94, something like that. Probably, wait a minute. Yeah, it must have been around that time.
So were you 18? Did you graduate from high school that year? If so, then it was that year.
Yeah.
Awesome.
It has to have been around that time because Jay's a couple of years older than me. He's 3 years older than me, so he was actually... He was in college. Yeah, he must have been like a sophomore or a junior, something like that, I think, because the first X Games was 98, and I was 21 at that point, and Lion had already been around and kicking for a while, so I'm pretty sure Lion started in 95 officially, but it was probably, you know, he had this idea, and we probably were playing with my father's welder, kind of trying to figure that thing out, like 93, 94-ish, probably.
Dang, how those,
so here's my first question. So now that he dated you as a fan, like, were you doing, when did you start to do tricks that weren't an upright 360 or a Daffy? At what age were you doing something where it was with a grab, landing, or going off backwards or whatever? And before, what year?
I don't know. I started skiing when I was 11. My father taught me how to ski, so I started late. But all throughout middle school and high school, we were skateboarding in like, like, I started snowboarding in 99. So, I mean, you're definitely doing tricks with grabs on a snowboard and a skateboard and my skate. So, that whole thing started late 80s, you know, when I was kind of getting into that whole deal. First grab on skis, I don't know, probably. So, we actually built a jump. We had, like, this hill, this kind of sledding hill in my backyard. We built a jump back there. It's on the first ever Line catalog, which is this like 8.5 piece of paper, 4.5 black and white photo. It was there in my backyard on this little kicker that we built where we just started messing around. I think we were doing like a flying fish grab way back in the day that we saw inline skater guys do. So it was probably early 90s, I guess.
So here's my next fan question. As someone, same time, I watched kids putting their tails in like, in Minnesota, the thing was they took 210s, put their tails in an oven, and then, because that's how you would bend a hockey stick, right? In the oven, a wood hockey stick. So they got the theory from that shit. And then they would drill their rollerblade boots to their skis because that's what they were comfortable thinking in their head, landing backwards, taking off. So when you, but these guys were all in moguls and upright aerials with me. When you were doing this shit, and Jay's thinking his, whatever he's thinking with the ski blades, how do you even like come up with not adapting like a solution twin tip, not adapting to whatever industry has, but like going so far out of the box to be like, let's create something that's 100 centimeters shorter. Like, first of all, why did you have to go so short in order to go backwards or to create the product you wanted?
I don't know. I mean, you know, Jay was the one who basically created the product. The whole way it started was he was a senior, college at the University of Buffalo in Western New York. He was in like a product design class or something, and the project was reinvent a product. Like, take something that exists and reinvent it. And up until that point, like I said, we had always been snowboarding, we had always been skiing, inline skating. So we were always going forward and backwards, two directions at least, on everything except a pair of skis. So in theory, he's like, why don't I take a snowboard and just shrink it down to half the size, like take a snowboard at 160 or whatever it is. Well, I guess it'd be a 180 something, a big snowboard, right? If you shrunk that in half, but essentially he shrunk it in half and was like, all right, well, let's mount some ski bindings on this, see if we can basically kind of find skate, ski, snowboard, skateboard on a pair of short skis and see if we can crack. So that's sort of, that was his thought process in terms of like making it evolve products that were out there, right? Because nobody was really going backwards on skis. And I even think maybe those Eric Pollard and some of his other buddies out in Mount Hood, they were making these little like
solution twin tips. Yeah, Griffin Cummings and Josh Frazier.
Yeah, Frazier, those dudes. Like you basically just like bolt this thing on the tail of your ski and it, you know, have a tail on it. But I think that was after the fact, or maybe it was right around the same time. Like
it was about the same time, 95, 96, when everyone was doing their own thing in regions.
Yeah.
And then here's my next question on this one was, so these rollerbladers, so say 94, 95, rollerblading was bigger than skateboarding, right? In the world and sales and all this stuff. This is for sure, because I know sales numbers and all this stuff. What they did were they were all these skateboarding teams were giving their inline skaters these winter snowblades as not manufactured by the rollerblade companies, but they're like, hey, this is rollerblading on snow, because of a huge rollerblade industry in like Minnesota and stuff like this. And so these guys had ski blades, I remember in 93, 94, that weren't Bigfoot. And so they were trying to do all their grinds and stuff. And I remember seeing it a little bit, but I didn't even think of it as skiing, because they were just like, oh yeah, we're doing our rollerblade stuff. So yeah. I wasn't thinking the conversion. And Jay, so I'm interested, when you first started, like 95, 96, and you went out and skied with other ski-bladed, whatever you want to call it, skied with other kids that were skiing on short twin-tip skis, did they come from rollerblading backgrounds, or were they multi-snow sport people?
I mean, so those are like early day line guys, right? Like line ski, the team, those were all mainly skiers. I mean, maybe we all had random stuff, but I think the whole influx of the inline guy took place when, you know, Serge Mayu and Nicky Adams and Jean Gagnon, some of those dudes were coming in out of Quebec. Like that's when it really started to kind of take this turn towards being inline influenced. But before that, I think it was mainly snowboard influenced, and it was being led by guys that wanted to do something different, because the skis that they had access to were basically holding them back, right? So, and I don't think that ski boarding, which thing, snowblading, which is like such a slap to the dudes that actually thought ski boarding was cool, because we didn't want to be known like Salmon's guys. Like Salmon, they
because that's a brand name, correct? Ski blade. It's what the brand that Salmon called his ski board?
Yeah, rollerblading versus line skating. Like in the early days, we always wanted sport to be kind of known as something different. So like, we sort of came up with this idea of this name of skateboards, right? Whereas like Snowblade was one product, but whatever. You're like tapping into like a little thorn in my side from 25 years ago that I could care less about anymore. But like back in the day, we didn't want to be called like Snowbladers, because that just meant you had like an affiliation with Salmon, right?
Yeah.
Which was sort of like the opposite of what we wanted to be back in those early days. But I think for the most part, it kind of got... It was like guys who were feeling held back by their skis that didn't just have to resort to snowboarding to do something cool. They kind of got on a pair of short twin tip skis or ski boards, whatever you call them.
It's just super interesting to me, because as a upright aerial skier, I'll call myself at the time, to not see anyone in my circles of freestyle be drawn to this. The shorter skis, like it was interesting looking back on it now. You're like, wow, we did ballet moguls and aerials. Why wouldn't we have done something that allowed more freestyle? And it kind of shows how conformed it was, right? If that wasn't fun to us. But that's why you guys were interesting and rebellious, because you guys came from such a passion of doing something. Like there was no outlet. You didn't come from racing or fucking moguls, like the majority of the other creators of our sport.
If anything, like I've known Jay since I was 11. So, I mean, we're talking 35 years now or something. I've known that guy. So, and I grew up with him and his brothers, and we were sort of free ride guys before free ride was a thing. Like, we just went and skied moguls all day long, not mogul team, be like, you know, super proper Johnny Mosley style, or those guys that had to do it like a certain way to be judged. Right, based on criteria, we were just like freestyle, free ride, do it your own way kind of skier guys who also snowboard and skateboard. It was just this whole action sport kind of influence thing. And I don't think we ever felt that ski boards were gonna, right? There was going to be an evolution. Keyboards served a purpose in the beginning to start to expose people to new things that could be done better than the upright aerialist style. So we were never going to keyboard forever, right? Like, in all honesty, I think that thing lasted like 5 or 6 years. It didn't last forever. I mean, there were 3X games, 99, 2000, that we did on ski boards. And then after that, ESPN said, for whatever reason, I don't know, they said, hey, let's just move everything all twin tip ski. So at that point, then I switched over, I guess, back to regular long skis because I grew up anyway. You know?
And did you really go to long skis, though? I mean, you're a short guy.
Yeah, not the first year. Like, I rode a pair of 165s. It was the first year in the X Games,
yeah,
which may have been on the shorter side. But when you're going from, like, having learned all these tricks on a 98 or a 90-length ski to then going to a 165 was longer. But then, I think my last pro model was a 178 or something like that, right? Like, and now you're just like, but when, before that, I mean, when I was young, I was skiing 190s. You're supposed to, like, go up to your wrist, right? So it's not like whatever. You just, like, evolve. You just use different tool to do the things you want to do, and then eventually you find the one that just suits all purposes. So it was evolution, man. That's all it was, really.
And back in the day, like, most of the parks were reserved to snowboarders and who didn't really like skiing and things of that fashion. So Stratton Pipe at some point opened up their half pipe to ski boarders. And I was curious to know how the dynamics between ski boarders and snowboarder was at that stage.
Yeah, that didn't go well. That's like throwing a cat and a dog in a barrel and putting a lid on top. You know, it's like, have fun, see if you can get along. And it wasn't going to work. I mean, snowboarders hated us because that was the only thing they had. Like, but everybody hated snowboarders in the beginning, right? Like, I remember back in the day, we used to have to call mountains to find out if they allowed snowboards on the hill. And some of them did, but then you still had to take a test to prove that you could make turns and get on and off the chairlift. Like, this is back in the late 80s. And so all the skiers, all the old-time skiers, they hated snowboarders back then. And then once the snowboarders got accepted and they had earned this little area of the mountain that's all their own, the snowboard park, they didn't want to let skiers in because supposedly, like, we had to hate each other because we old skiers hated them, whole mess. And then, like, even the first year that I got invited to do the X Games, my fourth X Games, which was 2001, like, I got invited by ESPN to do it on long skis because I had gotten, like, a medal in the first three events for ski boards, but they have a ski board event, and they're like, oh, well, Mike kind of has earned the right to have an invite, canceled the sport he's doing. He's pretty good. Let's give him a shot long skis. And, like, even then, like, skier guys, they didn't want me in that event either because they didn't think I was a skier. I was just a ski boarder for those guys. So it's sort of like I spent a lot of years being not liked by people just for what I was riding on. You know what I mean? Even though I had everything. I'd been a skier forever, boarder forever. Then I rode these short skis for a while, back on long skis. But because you're doing something different, it's like, you know, people just kind of look at it like, nah, not a part of the crew.
Yeah, hence one of your statements in video or volume video magazine, issue 5.
Uh-oh.
Quote from Mike. Kids need to be more open-minded about what they see on the hill. Do you feel like that statement still holds up today? Like, I know you probably spend much less time on hill, but how do you feel about this statement still holding up?
I think now I think everybody is pretty cool with everybody at this point, which is awesome. I mean, I don't know. I think, how long has it been, Phil, since, like, hand drag started to become, like, a cool thing to do? You know, that's like 7-8 years now. I mean, that's after me. We weren't ever doing hand drags in our video parts, you know. But, like, I think when that started happening, and then when you started seeing, like, what some stuff that the traveling circus guys were doing, like Will and Annie, those dudes are like aliens. They're so far out with what they try to do. I think when all these things start happening, and guys like Eric Pollard and maybe even you, whoever, were like skiers that are well-known, seen on a snowboard, literally snowboarding, you started to break down all the barriers. And I think that's cool. So I think at this point, I think everybody's pretty well open-minded, accepting of whoever you are and whatever you do on the hill.
I watched that interview today, and the only thing I thought about is great advice for just the world. It's not really a ski thing. Just be open, you know? And like, because it's funny, as you get older, like, I talked to Matt Harvey for the first time ever in my life yesterday.
Really? Like,
Matt Harvey, the guy who started New Schoolers. Never talked to him in my life. And one of our random side tangents was like, man, how funny are the things that we got pissed about, you know, that like played such a big part in it, right? Whether it's snowboards, hate ski boarders, doesn't fucking matter. Yeah. You know, and so it's fun, like we evolved past such pettiness in a luxury sport. Give thanks for that. And yeah, man. So good words of advice for humanity.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't know if I was trying to be all that prolific back then, but
you weren't, but that's how serious we had to be. Because it was like you still like we could still in 2002 when you did that interview, we'd still roll to a park in Mammoth and someone would be like fucking skier. And you're like, what? So even though parks were open that later, it still had some like, it was cool to hate the skier kid who did the exact same jumps and rails as you for no reason other than they had skis and you had a snowboard. And it was just weird for a year or two.
And I think back in those days of the early 90s, when they started Line, he was kind of like the first Raj-born brand, right? So now there's a ton of them. They're all over the place. Like, I mean, Armada's even one of them, right? They came a few years after. Anybody can, if you can find access to like production of skis, almost anybody can start a brand if you have a way for people to follow you. But like, Jay was one of the first ones to do that.
And Jay was eight years before Armada.
Yeah. So. And then like all the guys that skied for Jay, sponsored by, or sorry, by Line, whatever, like, really sought after by these big brands, right? Like, and when I say big brands, ski brands, even like K2, Rossignol, Salomon, whoever, back in those days. So we were always fighting this battle where we were always kind of like going up against the big guys. We were these sort of unknown guys that were just kind of trying to break the rules and change the way things were looked at. And it was always like an uphill battle, right? But I think that's what made, that's what kind of defined the whole Line, to be honest with you, was sort of chip on our shoulders where we had to go and prove our worth and our value and, you know, our credibility to everybody who was out there at that time. So,
well, you did it at all levels. Like, think about you as the short ski guy. Think about how weird Osnes was at a 193 long twit, like when everyone came out with a 180. So it's like he figured out full spectrum, like even to the guy who skied and snowboarded, like with Skogan in Chapter 3, right? And and so, yeah, it's just that you guys were the, like, it wasn't even rebels. It was just people, maybe misfits is more like it, because no one understood why they should accept you.
Yeah.
But you guys, because I bugged out, dude. I think you're the first guy ever to do alley-oop flat spin in the pipe. So that's what I bugged out. I was like, yo, you did this on ski blades, man. In 96, I guarantee you no one else did an alley-oop flat spin in the pipe on the right wall. And then you did it with no tails. Big up yourself.
Yeah, that's true. It was just, you know, like I said before, like, it's just one tool to figure out how you want to do things. And you call it like a little training tool or something. I don't know what, but ski boards, they served a purpose. I think the biggest thing they served in terms of, you know, having an impact on skiing was before we went out that first X Games in 98, we spent like, and that was probably, you know, January. It was either the season or early season that year. We spent a ton of time at Stratton just trying to figure out how to ride Switch without snow plowing. Like, because that was the thing. Like, and that's where we were going to make a statement about what we can do on these different types of skis, is that you can literally like stagger and kind of get in like a scissor stance and just like carve the hell out of it backwards on a pair of skis. You don't have to drop into a jump and just go straight like fakey snow plow. That wasn't the way to do it. Like, so that was the biggest thing that ski boarding helped, you know, that was the biggest impact it had on skiing, I think, at some point in time, because then everybody started to figure out how to do it right. So I don't
know. I want a tangent to more Mike Nick awesome. Do you think you were the first guy ever to do a Switch 900 in a contest?
I think so.
I think so too. So I just want to say that, like, as far as I think it was at X Games in 2001, right? When you got fourth place?
I got fifth that year, I think, unless I'm wrong, but it was the, yeah, it was my fourth X Games. It was the, was it the second year? Was that Mount Snow?
Well, let me ask you, did one of the Schraub brothers beat you? Because I feel like they got fourth or fifth as well.
No, it may have been Sturbins. Was it Matt Sturbins?
Damn, Sturbins got fourth?
I could be wrong. I know Tanner won it, and this is where, like, this is a whole, like, story. Like, one of the things I'll never forget, like, from my ski history, I think Tanner won it with a Cab 7, but the previous year, a Cab 7 only earned a silver. So how?
Yeah, because Skogan did it the year before, and then Candide won with the D-Spin 9.
Yeah, Skogan did a Cab 7 the year before. So I think it was Tanner, and then it may have been CR and Evan possibly on that podium.
Yeah, it was exact. CR did Bio 9, and then Raps did D-Spin 9.
Yeah, and I either got fourth or fifth. I forget. But I was one of the few guys in that contest that year to do three different tricks in each run. It was the best of three. And I think I did the Cab 9 on my third run, I think.
Well, to my memory, you were the first guy ever to do a Cab 9 in a contest. To my memory, 10 years ago, like when I did interviews for Like a Lion, or 12 years ago, I talked about it with Tanner, and I have the clip somewhere, and Tanner admits you should have won, because I was bugged out. I thought you should have won at the time. But it was knowledgeable at the time what your background was, right? And so, like, I remember at the time, the argument was that your skis were too short. But when we put it in perspective, you're 5 foot what?
Aryan skis.
How tall are you?
I'm 5'8".
Okay, you're 5'8". You're on a 165. So same as probably Andre Spaghetti, but like even smaller by a lot, like Andre. So if we relate it to nowadays, and then Skogan was skiing on the same ski. He was on like a 162. Like I think he was on the same ski like at the X Games.
I think his skis were longer.
But he's a lot taller. Like, he's taller than you too.
Yeah, maybe a couple inches. But if we want to make an argument, like, what length were Vinny Dorian's skis? Because he was a short dude. I can't imagine he was on like something super long.
No, he was 170 because they all had. But at that time, like, I don't even know. But either way, like, I think the whole thing was you had a stigma or something. You were the first guy ever to do a Switch 9 at a contest, at a major contest, and then you were outside the podium. And it was just something. Same thing as like this. We could say like Mike Wilson, 2004 U.S. Open. He did a Switch double, right? Held a fucking safety the whole way and didn't even make it past qualifiers because we said doubles were aerials. And we all had a group. So in shaping this, and that's why this kind of show is so important, because it's just like, you know, like, there is reasons why certain things happened at the time, but also you were such a big influence on it. To be able to come and step up at a contest and everyone knows they couldn't do a Switch 9, holy shit. Like, it made a difference. It pushed everyone. And,
well, and then later in the year, like, that was the whole thing. So, like, before that contest, like, earlier in the season, you know, ESPN said, hey, we're not doing a ski board event, so Mike, we'll give you an invite to whatever the Ski Big Air, whatever you want to call it, Twin Tip Ski Big Air. And I was like, ah, shit, I haven't ridden a pair of skis in like 10 years. So I'm like, all right, so we got to figure this out, because, you know, when you go from a ski board to a ski, whatever, is there's more swing weight, like, you got to slow your rotations down, takeoffs and this and that. So Jay sent a bunch of the line guys out to Mammoth, and he was like, you got a week, go out there and figure it out. So went out there for a week and just rode the Mammoth Park with probably Pollard and Skogan and whoever, and I did it on those 165s. And I'll never forget, like, the first time I went to hit a jump and throw a Cab 5, I spun that thing way too early, and I whacked my hips on the takeoff of that. And I just got tossed. Like, it was crazy, because you have to really, like, hold your rotation before you take off in a whole different way. And so I had, in that 1 week, I had literally done every trick I'd ever done before on ski boards, on skis, except Cab 9. So that Cab 9 in the X Games, that was the first time I ever threw that trick. Not even that, like, it had never been done before. I had never done it either on a pair of longer skis.
Have you ever thought of, I hate to interrupt you, but it's my question, I know I'll forget, how many tricks you were, and I'm asking you this because I saw you do a switch backflip, I believe, in a 1998 skiboarding movie. So yeah. I was wondering, first of all, do you think you did a switch back first, like on skis, before Falou or these guys?
That I don't know. I have no idea.
Okay, because I remember actually the first switchback I remember was JF Coussin in the credits of Degenerate, so that would have been winter of 98. So I was just curious, in your head, do you know any tricks that you did that no one else did first?
I think I was one of the first guys to get on a podium doing a zero spin. I wasn't one of the first ones to do it, but at the World Ski and Snowboard Fest out in Whistler, I think other guys were throwing cab nines at that point.
So that was the shot from Stereotype, the switch straight air with the green bib.
It was in there. Okay. So I think, because I remember, I think Turpin got on the podium. That was a weird event. Somebody got hurt too, and I think something happened. But I think.
Yeah, a Scandinavian kid.
But I was only throwing zero spins in that event. I said, you know what? Like, I've been doing this cab nine thing, I'm gonna go out and just not spin at all. And I think I crashed on like the first two out of three. It's not easy, right? And that was an early days trick.
You know what it was? It was super slushy, super hot, because I remember talking with you because I filmed it as well. And the whole idea was everyone was grabbing and falling on the landing.
Yeah.
And I think Crichton won that time. He won the year before.
Event was actually Tanner Turpin and myself on the podium. So that was another one of those kind of first deals. But I remember like the X Games where it was my third run and I had been in first two runs and I looked at Pollard and I was like, hey man, like I should probably try this cab nine now. And he's just like, I'm like, I've never done it. And he goes, just do it. So like that was it.
Coussin just joined. I just want to say, Coussin, we just said you were the first guy ever on skis to do a switch backflip. Big up yourself, Coussin.
So two things I've never done on a pair of skis, and I never will, is a mute grab. Literally have never done a mute grab or a straight backflip.
Never.
Went straight to the switch backflip, first things first.
Yeah. Were you ever bummed? Because the straight backflip gets the most cheers under a ski lift, right?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It does. But like what you were saying earlier, Iberg, about like, you know, upright aerialist, that whole thing, like, I don't know. When Mosley did that mute grab in the Olympics, I'm like, oh, that trick's done. Like, she just never did a mute grab after that. Like, literally. And I don't even think I ever had done one before that. Like, I just never did one. And a straight backflip, never did a straight backflip either.
Still time, man. Yeah. Mike.
Be fun. I haven't hit a jump in a while.
And transitioning through, like, basically your last segment, correct me if I'm wrong, was in Ready, Fire, Aim with Poor Boys, perhaps? Like your last shots in a movie?
I don't know. Did that come after Stereotype? I thought Stereotype was...
No, Ready, Fire, Aim was the next year.
Mm.
I forgot about it too, man. Phil educated me. He's like, man, he got a Ready, Fire, Aim segment. I said, what?
Yeah, it was short, but yeah, there's a couple shots in there, I think. Yeah.
All through this, like in 1999, lest people forget, you founded, I think it's 1999, correct me again if I'm wrong, but you founded a brand, a notorious outerwear brand, first rider to start and operate his outerwear brand in freeskiing, Cyber Cartel. How did that start? How does the idea of you, a pro athlete, popping off, like winning X Games medals, start an outerwear brand, like on top of being the athletic feat you are?
And I'm curious what year you started it, too.
It was 98.
Okay.
It was years after Jay had started mine. Myself and... Well, Jay's brothers, Doug and Matt, three Leventhal brothers, Doug and Matt and I started Cyber. And I think it was, you know, we had seen, like, hey, you know, Jay did it. Like, he's not rocket science, right? Takes some hard work and like a good idea and then just figuring out how to make it happen. But I think outerwear was, it had a pretty traditional ski look to it, you know? So we wanted to do something different that was a little more snowboard style and just kind of cooler. So we honestly started actually screening our own t-shirts like somewhere in my apartment or, yeah, boom, there you go. Look at that thing, man. Vintage. Yeah, we just started screen printing t-shirts and we just figured that maybe, you know, we can represent a whole group of skiers that are underrepresented at that point in time. Like, so we always, the idea was that like Cyber was the brand. Cyber was the name of the road that I grew up on, Cyber Road.
Like, oh, right.
Where the word came from. But like Cyber was the brand, and then the Cartel was this group of people that were all basically riding vintage, like people that were trying to evolve the sport. That group, the Cartel, like these people. And that was kind of how we created this attraction and inclusion, I guess you could say, and a following for the brand. So, and then it grew. It grew from t-shirts to, like, you know, better streetwear, I guess, and then eventually to outerwear. And
well, taking a 2001, 2002 timeout, you created my favorite sweatpants of all time. I wore it every day for 3 years straight. I loved them. I loved them to the highest level. I ripped the string out of the bottom because I walked on them for too long. Then, during the pandemic, January 2021, Eric found a place called G-Style USA. And let me tell you, I got red Cyber pants for $25. Same Come fit, on. Same feel, same cut, same waistband, dog.
Yeah, look at those things.
$25. Anyone want the best sweatpants ever? G-Style USA. Same as Cyber Cartel 2002.
Yeah, nice, man.
So thanks, man. I'm sorry to interrupt you. That's dope.
So yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, I don't know. I guess, I've done a couple things to kind of pave some paths. So it's been, this is a while ago.
Quick question. What inspired the logo? Notorious logo, because everybody like has this printed in their mind.
That logo is awesome, man. That is a classic logo right there. It was Jay Lepkoff, brother Doug, who created that. And I don't know. We were just sitting around coming up with ideas for names and concepts of what we were trying to accomplish. And I think Doug had whipped up a couple different logos. And I don't remember what the other ones may even have been. But that was just the one. We saw that thing, and it was like this Japanese pagoda house, like roof style thing. It was just powerful. So we went with that, and it worked. It was pretty awesome. That brand should come back.
Shane McFalls in the comment is asking, tell the Smuggler's Notch Cyber story, if that rings a bell.
Smuggler's Notch Cyber story.
Do you have a Young Guns or something?
Shane and I still work together. I don't know what he's talking about.
Maybe we should call him in. That's the best part about this live thing, man. It's been so fun.
Is a historian, man. Bring that guy in. You have his number?
Call him in, Phil.
And he's a huge Cyber fan, that guy.
I am too. I still want to know how it transitioned to Orage and then the end of it. I'm interested.
Whoa. Not so fast, though.
Oh, slow it down. Hey!
Guest.
Hey.
Dude, this is awesome.
The Cyber story is the one of you in the past few years, you saw somebody with a coat and tried to take their picture.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. It's the worst moment of my life, literally. It was embarrassing, horrible. So we're in a lift line, and, like, at Smuggler's Notch in northern Vermont, it's a sick mountain. It's got, like, killer terrain, but, like, these old double chairlifts. Shane's gone. But it's got these old chairlifts, and the lifts get backed up. So we're sitting in lift line for, like, 15 minutes. This is probably two winters ago, maybe. And I look, like, in the middle of the crowd, there's a guy with an old Cyber jacket. And I'm like, wow, this is unbelievable. And, that's probably 15, 18 years maybe since that coat was made. Like a wicked long time. So I kind of like get my camera out and I'm take a picture and send it to Jay Lev and be like, dude, like, Cyber still lives, man. This is awesome. Because, like, honestly, like, one day at every ski season, almost every year, I'll see someone wearing a Cyber piece. It's crazy. But so I saw this guy. I take my camera out, my phone, take a picture. I send it to Jay. 10 minutes goes by. I'm skiing with my son, who at that time was probably 16, 15 or 16. We get all the way to the front, like, wave your pass, and we're about to get on the lift, and I hear some lady screaming, that guy's taking pictures of children, like, like, freaking out, and I'm like, I don't know what's going on. It was like 10 minutes had gone by, like, I had no idea directed towards me. Then she, like, comes running up through the lift line and starts pointing at me, you're taking pictures of children, craziest thing I've ever heard, and I'm like, what? And she's going nuts, and I'm like, lady, like, you have to, like, calm down. You can't scream. Lift line guy, he's like, you got to get out of this lift line. I'm calling ski patrol. You can't take pictures of children. I'm
like, my nigga's fucking exposed.
Yeah. So then, like, so I finally realized, like, what's going on. And I'm like, lady, I will show you the picture that I took. And if your kid is, like, 25 or 26 with a long ponytail and a beard, I'm like, I took a picture of that guy. But I think that's. So I took the photo out, showed her. She's like, that's my kid. And it was like, on like the very side, like the picture, you could see like his back. And I'm like, but lady, like, there's also 100 other people in this line. Like, you can see the jacket, like, Cyber logo right in the middle. I'm like, that's who I was taking a picture of. It was a whole thing, man. But I'd like never felt like that in my life where someone was freaking out, like, I was taking a picture of a kid. In an inappropriate way. Then I get up here, you'll kind of, this is sort of like ties home to you. So I get airlift, I meet the guy at the top with the Cyber jacket, and I'm like, hey man, like, I gotta just let you know, I just took this picture. It's a picture of you, but here's why. I'll delete it if you want. And he's like, dude, that is the best, like, story ever. And I was like, well, where'd you get that jacket? He's like, I got it at the Orage sample sale up in Quebec.
So does he know who you were?
I don't think he did, but he, like, he figured it all out. And, like, so anyway, he was cool with it. The mom was cool. And the whole thing got, you know, worked out. But you can get in trouble for taking pictures of people you don't know, I guess. Some people don't like it. Anyway.
Lesson learned, man. Thanks to Shane for dropping in and giving us insight.
Yeah.
And, on this story right here. So, like, parallel to Cyber was events, radical events that you put on. For instance, one that was atypical and ahead of its time, perhaps, like, took a bit of inspiration from skateboard demo tours, was the Cyber Sessions. Talk to us about that. How, like, then at that point, still pro athlete, brand entrepreneur, starting your own events as well.
Yeah, I think the deal there was, like, I mean, I grew up skateboarding in the 80s, and I'll never forget, I went to this Powell and Peralta, you know, like, demo at this skate shop where I grew up, and they rolled in this little mini half pipe on the back of a truck, and they folded it out, and these guys were skating, and, you know, so there was a big thing, like, there was a whole demo tour thing, right? That was, like, a big deal in skate culture back in the days. So really, it just kind of spawned from that. It was like, what can I do to kind of have all these pro athletes like the Three Phils and Skogan and
Yeah. Well, can you tell me what it was? Like, refresh my memory. Like, Cyber Sessions, you traveled around the country and showed up at different resorts, and they just showed how dope they were, or what?
No, it was, so we picked a couple resorts that we wanted to go to, and, you know, maybe some athletes had an affiliation with them, but basically said, like, hey, it was kind of like, it was certainly before social media, I think. But basically what we did was we promoted the fact that the team, like, pro guys, were going to be at these mountains on these dates, just come out and shred the park with us. So it was like, it was a thing that had never really been done before in skiing, where you're basically able to just kind of come and ski with pros. And there was nothing involved with it. And we're all going to be at the same park at the same time. And we're going to just go ski this thing and hang out. But it was kind of maybe inspired by Glenn Plake's, whatever, his whole, like,
down road home tour he ran.
like that guy went everywhere and skied with whoever, and everybody loved it. But it was a way of just doing something different where you didn't have to pay to be a part of it. It wasn't a competition. Like, you just went and you skied with these dudes that you saw in film back in those days, and kids were fired up. And
so, as a business owner before social media, Cyber Cartel is your company. It's what you name the kind of tour, Cyber Sessions. How was your turnout? Because we did a tour. I had Phil and Henrik and Paul, B. Paul, go on, you know, that Inspired demo tour, like 2013. Like, how was the turnout? Like 2000. It looks like that from that photo would have been like 2003 is when you did a Cyber Session, or four from the hat.
I don't know. I forget.
But like, I mean, you were at every stop, right?
Yeah, I think
What was it like when you just show up with like superstars, whether it's legends like the Phils or Skogan and Pollard on the come up? And
yeah, I mean, I don't know, 50, 60 kids. I don't really remember, to be honest with you. So I'm just throwing a number out, but I'm sure it's a pretty good crowd. And then like, it's probably about that many, I guess, because I think I do remember some photos where like we'd have a tent and then at the end of it, we'd meet at like 4 o'clock or whatever at the end of the day. And we would just throw out all kinds of swag from our sponsors, and kids were pumped, signing autographs and whatever. So there's got to be a photo somewhere. I remember it in my brain, where there's a pretty good turnout. I mean, it wasn't like hundreds and thousands, but enough kids where you're all training through the park and you're kicking up some dust because there's a lot of kids
dropping. That's awesome, man. Big up yourself on that, because to be honest, I never knew Cyber Sessions was the demo tour model.
Yeah.
You know, like I only saw it as, I guess, I don't know what it is, before social media. So I only got one page that Phil probably showed on the screen of ways to absorb it. And then maybe however it was told about the next year in an ad.
Yeah, I think we did those for a couple of years. And then we expanded. We did the Cyber Young Gun Open, which was basically a four-stop contest. And like at each, we did one at Stratton. We did one at, I think, Copper. We did one at Mount Seymour out in BC, and we did one up in your hometown, right? In Quebec, Phil, didn't we?
Yep, Mount Avila. Yep. Not my hometown, but yep. And LJ won that one.
Yeah, so we did four of those, and at each stop, like whoever won that slope style event basically got sponsorships from all the sponsors that I had. And then later that winter, we took those four athletes and we put them on an Orage Masters team out in Whistler. And the names that came out of that event are pretty awesome. Like Shea Flynn won one of those. LJ Strenio, he won one.
Matt Walker
won one. And Joe Schuster won one.
So
all those dudes ended up having, to whatever degree, like a legit pro career and went on after that. So that thing was pretty cool, actually.
And hell yeah, man.
So was Cyber, did it get absorbed by Orage, or did you shut it down? Like, I guess I never know the end story of Cyber too, as a fan of what you did, and like wore your shit every year for years. But like
the end of that was, so I sold Cyber to Orage.
Okay.
Because we were making hoodies and t-shirts and sweatpants and stuff, and we kind of wanted to take it to the next level. And honestly, back then, like making outerwear was no simple feat.
It's expensive as fuck with all those SKUs.
It's insane. The textile industry is crazy. Someone from Orage basically said, hey, you're sponsored by Orage. Like, you're one of our athletes and you're also running your own brand. Why don't we just kind of like join forces? But we basically sold Cyber to Orage, and then a couple of the guys were basically running Cyber and utilizing Orage, like their business, all their resources for production, distribution, reps, you know, sales reps, trade shows, all that stuff. And then after, I think, about 5 years, in all honesty, I think the people who were Orage at that point in time, they saw how well Cyber was doing with the youth market and wanted a piece of that action, but they just weren't able to get it done with Orage because Orage was kind of like, let's say, like for skiers 25 and older and a little more traditional, whereas Cyber was definitely for the younger kids who were more of new school, park, whatever. So they decided to kind of stop moving forward with Cyber, and I had no decision in it because I sold it to them.
So here's my quick question. Phil just showed that it said Cyber merges with Arouse 2007-12. Did you, when you merged, did you take over like as a team manager for Arouse and creating their image for outerwear at that time?
No, but I mean, I guess I was a part of it, right? Like they knew that they wanted to bring, they wanted to inject a little more youth into Arouse.
Did you sign Phil Casabon?
I don't know. Phil is like either Jamie or me and Jamie. I don't know.
Do you know Phil?
Maybe. Yep, it was Jamie. I was on before Mike okay. was on Arouse.
Yeah.
But certainly once Mike got on, things took a turn for the better. The team was notorious then. That's what, like Arouse golden years when Mike got on, like for real.
And that's what I wanted to big up you too on, Mike, because like I grew up where Arouse was some really fluorescent popsicle shit in the early 2000s, right? And when you were like, say, do you remember the jacket? I think it was like 2001, like your neon green one with a Arouse that stuck over the chest. You were a Arouse athlete, right? At that year?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was just like the ugliest shit. And then whether your athlete input or when you came on board and then gave athletes like Phil access to create dope shit where you probably had to fight when they're like 2XL. We're not going to sell 2XL to our market. And you're like, yeah, but we're branding. We're not selling this jacket. We're making Arouse cool. And so, like, that's what I got to watch from afar. Want to high-five you because you made a whole brand cool for a small time period.
They had, like, an older school mentality about them. But they had really good designers. Like, their design team was really good. And honestly, Arouse was a pretty amazing brand when they were doing what made them amazing. Like, when they were really using all these crazy alternative fabrics and trying new stuff and basically making look like streetwear. Like, you could wear it downtown, you could wear it on the mountain, and it was technical. But then they kind of started to fall off when they tried to play. They started to care more about big numbers and sales. Because let's face it, like, anything that is, like, core and innovative for the most part, at least in the beginning, not going to be a massive growth driver, right? Like, yeah, for
it's investment.
Yeah, so they wanted to grow, and I think during those years, that company was actually eventually sold to a capital investment firm, and during those years, that is when I think the brand kind of started to die, unfortunately.
Because was that on your out then with Arouse? Or?
Yeah, eventually. So then eventually I helped a guy named Eric who... Eric started Arouse back in 1980. Eric had sold, included Cyber, Arouse, this other women, Loli. Yeah. So there was a bunch of brands that were basically in this court. Then they sold them to the capital investment firm. And those guys started to sit behind the, you know, the driver's wheel and dictate which brands we're going to get invested into. And it wasn't Cyber and it wasn't Arouse. It was some of the other brands that were had a little more mass market potential, you know? So at that point I said, hey, Eric, like, your brand you started is dying. If you want to save it, like, we need to buy the brand back. And you got to kind of come back into the fold and, you know, we've got to take it away from this company we sold it to. So basically, Eric and I worked a deal to buy Arouse back from the company they sold it to. And then I worked there for a couple of years when Eric had regained. Just wasn't necessarily what I was hoping for. So at that point, which is probably 8 years ago now, maybe, I don't even remember when it was. That's when I kind of exited the whole ski industry. So this is a while ago.
Awesome. It's fun to learn, Mike.
Yeah. I mean, it's.
Yeah.
It's a whole thing.
Go ahead, Mike.
Like, I started skiing, you know, like, my first X Games, I was 21, right? That's pretty old compared to nowadays. Kids are, like, 14 winning. So I always knew that I wasn't going to have this lifelong career as an athlete. At some point, your body just starts to kind of not be able to handle it. Just literally physically, you got to kind of go in a new direction. So that's honestly why I started Cyber in the beginning, is because I just wanted to do something that I thought was cool and that hadn't been done before. In terms of the industry or brand, and then maybe that brand keep me in the ski industry for as long as I wanted to be, because it was something I wanted to do. But you know,
no, it wasn't access to everyone, because at there, no outerwear company was making street clothes, right? Like, so it's like you could go get the fills, and Phoenix isn't their biggest sponsor, isn't going to care because they didn't pay them to wear a t-shirt and a sweatshirt.
Right. So that was the weird thing. So then I had like all these other dudes that were, I was competing again, being with in films and whatnot. I mean, these guys were all skiing for other brands, but then they were skiing for my brand to wear a t-shirt and a hoodie. Like, it was weird.
It was dope, man, because if their jacket was open on their ad, it showed Cyber. You know what I mean? You were able to infiltrate with the beanie space and the t-shirt sweatshirt space just for branding. And because of that, like, no, that billboard space was for sale with everyone, and no one had any, even like, it's kind of like watching Tall Tee. Like, no one wanted to produce a Tall Tee because it would add too much to their line. So they let Tall Tee just make everything and own that cat because they didn't care. They were just like, all right, you can make t-shirts and sweatshirts. We don't want to make that.
Yeah. And those guys were fired up. It was something cool. Like, that brand represented who they were, you know?
Yeah. Whereas
other brands like Phoenix, those guys were paying to be able to do what they wanted to do. But like Cyber, the brand paid them a little bit too, right? They photo incentives, and they got paid a little bit of money or whatever. But they were basically just getting gear that they loved. So it was a whole different thing.
Along these lines that we're speaking of, here's a quote from Mike of Axis Magazine, who was also founded by my Matt Harvey, I believe, that we spoke before.
Matt, no,
that
was a quote.
That was Jay's young.
Oh, word.
Yes. Cool. The Leventhal brothers, the three of them, like, Matt started Axis and worked at Powder Magazine. Jay started Line, and Doug and I started Cyber. So, like, all three of those Leventhal brothers were pretty in the scene, too.
Big up Leventhal.
Instrumental. Yeah, big up the Leventhal family.
I can always tell Matt taking photos in SB1 because he always takes guy in the sky shots. And when he goes in the back, you can see half his head's bald. Fucking awesome. I hope Matt's watching Mott.
Yeah, so here's the quote from Mike Nick, the prolific. The problem is that the older generation who currently runs skiing with their giant companies, corporate madness, and millions of dollars are simply using the youth and his movement as a marketing tool, but they are not actually giving back, building a future for you. They're afraid of the risk and fully backing something with such a short history. This goes back to 2003. Since that statement, have you seen any change in the overall climate of skiing? Is it better or worse, in your opinion, than it was since that quote?
Yeah, I mean, that was probably when I was, I mean, that was 20 years ago, right? So I was 26 at that point in time, and I was probably fired up and trying to, you know, focused on changing the industry and putting my spin on it, or at least helping get it where we all wanted it to go. So maybe I was a little naive back then, or kind of trying to be a tough guy or something. I don't know. But and it certainly wasn't back then what we wanted it to be, but it is now. I mean, there's so many more brands now. I think skiing in general has changed. I mean, media, magazines are kind of dying, like, you know, I don't know. But there's so much more going on now. I think skiing is in a way better place now. I mean, Phil, like what you and Henrik did with your video series, like what guys like the Traveling Circus guys are doing. I mean, I'm kind of spacing on some of the newer ones, but there's so much content that's coming out now. I think the industry is a much better place from the skier's perspective, right? And I would say probably from the industry as well, but I've been out of the industry for a while. Like, you know, I haven't been to a trade show since, I mean, it's probably been 10 years that I've been out of it on like the business side of things. So I really, you know, I still hang out with Jay Leb. I see him all the time, but even he kind of broke again when he started to pay skis and he moved out of it. He stopped going to trade shows and selling to ski shops.
Double, like, he just broke the mold in life.
So, you know, I don't know. I don't know if it's better or not in as good of a place as it should be, but it changed. And I think it's because of our generation, where you know, Cyber's not around anymore, but at least I was able to kind of help start to do something to get people to move away from it. Like all the, you know, like Armada as a brand too, Forefront, all those guys, like the athletes needed to kind of take over, and I think we finally did it. And I think what you're seeing now is the results of all that early stuff. And then like what your generation did, Phil. So who's that?
Hey,
Eric Pollard on the cover of that bitch.
This is relevant for what you guys are talking about for a bunch of reasons.
Oh shit, he got the actual article.
I'll show you why.
Pollard, Bellinger, royalty. He does the dope one.
Hang on. This is the Axis style issue, which is pretty, it's a pretty good one, still in mint condition. If anybody wants to buy it off me for, you know, hundreds of dollars. But what I was searching for is the Albany Rail.
Yeah, buddy, that's in Troy.
Okay, the Troy Rail with the studded belt.
Yeah.
Which is pretty sick.
Closing shot, fucking propaganda.
The propaganda ad. And then the Iberg interview.
Yeah,
we all tied in 2001
with the hoodie on, dude.
Look at you, Iberg.
What's changed in 22 years?
There it
is. Nick doesn't slide rails like that no more. That's what changed.
No, it's been a while.
Look at this editing, man. This is a professional show, Phil. Live interaction, content talking with visuals.
Yeah.
We got guests with the actual material on the line.
Yep.
People ain't never seen this before.
No. I told you, Shane is the real deal. And look at that old Oraja.
Rex.
This was like a whole series of ads.
Yeah.
And one of them, they used to have quotes like hidden in them. And there was one and the quote was, to be a real killer on the dance floor, you have to practice every day. And I put that as my senior quote in my yearbook.
I think
Rod made the difference.
That was either my ad that they did. Phil, you can find it. Yeah, it's right there.
21st, Montana.
So that's when Rod started.
There it is.
They started morphing that year a little more of a younger brand. And I think that was probably the last year. Well, no, I guess I was still wearing a Cyber hat in that ad, but
yeah, I used that as my senior quote in my high school yearbook. Oh, the one other thing I would say, I got a 10-4 off of eBay about a year ago for $30. And when I put it on, dude, I was so impressed at like, well, A, there's like 8 million pockets on the thing. I mean, there's just pockets everywhere, but there's a powder skirt that's legit. There's like the bum straps for your hands. There was just all of this stuff that today would be such a pain to have a factory make. I feel like most, I don't know, like the, I got a bunch of Orage coats later on in Traveling Circus that didn't have like as many like tech features. And honestly, that 10-4 coat is so warm, I can't even really wear it skiing because you just sweat in it. But there was definitely an attention to detail that was pretty impressive for that time.
So if anybody out there has a 10-4, give it to Shane. Or
I got one.
Yeah, but the jacket I've been looking for forever, there was a black and white striped jacket. It looked like the Hamburglar. It was called the Turkish. If anybody has a black and white Turkish in XL, I would pay for that jacket.
You wear XL clothes?
Huh?
You wear XL size clothes?
No, but I just know it's probably like the XL from back in those days is probably like a large in these days. So a large or an XL would be good.
Oh, Mikael and Tanner have the same hair. We talked about the hair last week.
Everyone
rubbed their hair in 2001.
That's it. That's the one right there. That black and white jacket. That thing was awesome. Look at that thing.
Look at that. Man, this is great. I'm enjoying. I just want to read your magazine. Phil, I wasn't even looking at Phil's magazines
for days.
Got four.
I have a lot of magazines.
Someone has the Turkish and the tan. The real Nikki. That can't be Nikki Adams. That'd be dope. That's, I see Yannick was on here. I see Turpin was on here. Kusan. We got some crew today.
You can go through that magazine. I can tell you who those photos are. So that's Eric Pollard right there out in Mount Hood.
I heard that this rail is on the north side of Mount Hood in a crevasse, and they can't pull it out anymore. The Constam family refuses to pay to have that rail brought back over to the main face, unfortunately.
If anybody's wondering, scrolling through the Axis magazine right there is none other than Shane McFalls, who did most of the Traveling Circus episodes, legendary shit, paradigm shifting episodes.
Hey, do you still have the Cyber website?
No, they took it.
No, they're gone skiing.
That's Eric Pollard up at the top. That's me in the middle, and that's Mike LaRoche at the bottom.
This is at Wendell's.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Yeah, but like, who's paying for that website to be up?
I don't know.
Someone that loves you. Someone bought inspiredmedia.tv after I quit it. That person must really love it. I don't know who they are.
So if somebody was going to start making Cyber again, who would they have to go to? To Araj?
Probably.
Well, who's going to do that?
Uh-oh. Actually, you know, a guy from Japan emailed me about a year ago to, like, start making Cyber stickers and giving them out in Japan. And I was like, I don't know who would allow you to do that, but it's crazy, man. There's still talk about that brand coming back. That brand should come back.
Yeah.
It could. It has a history.
Yeah. Look at that guy.
Yes, Bell. Belanger, Stephen Play.
Iberg, what are you doing these days? What are you up to? All right,
I got to go back to work. Thank you. All right.
Man, this is about you, Mike Nixon.
Yeah, but there's other interesting things to chat about.
Phil, dude, Phil hasn't even talked. He is such a great journalist. Have you listened to every time he asks you a question? He thought about this, researched it, and pulled up quotes. He's on quote number three, next quote, if he has another. So I don't want to take away from Phil's shine as an investigative reporter.
It's not easy, man, because like Shane and I, we still work together, like, and we do like video projects, and a lot of times these video projects, like helping other businesses and brands tell a story. I'm a horrible interviewer. Like, I can't do it. I can't come up with questions. Like, I can talk and sit here and like come up with questions on the fly. But the fact that you did all this research in the beginning and then articulate those questions, it's awesome, man. So it's good.
Nothing less, dude. We're fucking stoked to have you on, and the opportunity is gorgeous. You know, like, we don't have the platform. I mean, people don't know about you, most of the people, and just even myself, like, obviously I grew up watching you skiing, and we were in a close relationship through the Araj episode where you were managing the team, best brand manager in the game. And then I still like slacked on some of your history. Iberg put me on to all the ski board shit, and I'm watching you ski board in 1998 doing Switch 9 Louis Kangs. Another thing is Louis Kangs, man.
Yeah.
You brought those to the table big time. Yeah. Give thanks.
I know. Yeah, that's, I don't even know how that started. That was another thing that like some inline skater probably did. Like, we were just sitting there at one point just going, okay, cool, we got to grab our skis now. Like, what do we do? Like, you know, like, because it's not, I mean, skateboarding to snowboarding is easy. All the grabs are pretty much the same. And I don't know, we must have been looking at some inline mag or a video or something, and some guy did a Liu Kang, and that seemed like a cool thing to do. So,
here's my question. Now, if I was to watch a Phil do a Liu Kang, they would just drop one leg straight down and one leg straight up. Now, you had the Mick kick where the grab foot was straight up, and then you had a Daffy like other leg. So, what one's a Liu Kang? Did you see someone do it the straight leg out the way you did it? Because I think we always called it a Mick kick because of you. If you straight legged your Liu Kang, you were doing the Mick kick.
Right. It was probably an inline skater guy, because there are definitely some dudes back in the day that were doing Liu Kang wrong. It was just they just kind of pulled up one knee and safety grab with their other leg like hanging straight down. Like, there's more to it. It's like a whole kind of body positioning type thing. And like, the ultimate was to get your Kang leg like up as high as you could over your head. Or at least like that, but it wasn't a straight down kind of thing.
No, and I've seen that's what set you apart though from everyone else that did it. Like, at least the Phils kind of always would go into the Phil grab where they'd slowly go up and down with a little bit of tweak. So it wasn't so dramatic as far as like, let me just pull one leg straight up.
Yeah, like that flat five right there, Phil, that's the one.
That is the one.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just the way you had to do it, you know?
Well, you were the only one. Like, you know what I mean? Can you think of anyone else that did their Liu Kang like you?
Probably not back then.
Nah, mid kick.
You know.
Only one I can think of is Nicky Adams, which, ironically, or has a background in rollerblading.
Right. And Nicky, I think, grabbed the opposite way. So if Nicky was spinning left, he grabbed his right foot and then, like, kanged out his left leg. But where if I spun left, I would grab my left leg and kang out my right leg, which I think slowed my rotation a little bit. If you look at Nicky, he grabbed the opposite way, I think. And I always thought his were cool.
No, that's right.
Rotation. But yeah, you're right. But then later that year, I remember after that 1X Games, there were other guys that were trying to do it later on in the season. And I don't want to name names, but it wasn't looking good. They weren't doing it right.
I don't remember him doing it, so it must not have been shit.
Yeah.
Mid kick.
That was the deal, huh?
Mid kick lives on.
I think I texted you one time or something years ago. I think I don't know, you were doing some Liu Kang somewhere, and I'm pretty sure I texted you and gave you some props for it because you got good Kang style, buddy. Really nice. But I think you might do yours more like Nicky Adams.
Thank you so much.
If I
did some like Nicky.
I think you might. You might, if you spin
but
left.
But I did.
You Kang out your left foot and you spin left. I think.
I did both, but the real one was definitely inspired by you.
All right.
Where,
see. Oh, we lost Phil's audio.
Yeah, we did. But we lost your video. You're all frozen. I look all normal to myself. Phil's back. It's just Mike.
Yeah, I got it.
Mike's all frozen.
Yo, Mike, what's the internet situation where you at?
Should be good. I see everybody's moving for me right now.
Back. Better internet?
Really?
Better.
Oh, booyah. Here. You're back.
Is it back? We good?
Not for me.
No?
Oh, explosion on my cell phone. Calls.
Oh man, maybe it's Phil.
No, it's not me.
It's all Mike.
It's Mike. But yeah, we did it, man. We keeping the show 90 minutes and
we got open up for questions with Mike around.
Yep. Yeah. Let's get some people on the chat board to send your questions to Mike Nick, because so far we only had Shane McFalls do the knowledge. Let's have somebody else here ask something interesting.
Shane was amazing. Big up Shane for getting on the show. That was fun. Got to look through a whole magazine and stuff.
Hey, Phil, you don't see me anymore?
Stories. Mike Nick just went in the dark. He's going in the garage to smoke, too.
Really?
I can hear you now, Mike.
You don't see
best moment at U.S. Open. We got Chris Turpin, the one and only.
Turpin. Hey. You don't hear me, or do you see me, or what?
I see you and hear you.
Okay. I saw you guys the whole time. I saw it, and I heard everything.
Okay. Phil, ask, what question was that one?
Turpin asked, best moment at U.S. Open, Mike.
U.S. Open? I don't know. What
story is he thinking?
Back in those days, that's when, like, you would do, like, multiple events at those things. You do a big air, you do a half pipe event, and you do a skier cross event, which, like, skier cross is wicked fun if you've never done it before. So I don't know. I don't know what Turpin's talking about, but I would say maybe one of the more fun things during those days was, like, you know, you'd get all serious during the slope style event and try to win that, and then you would go and do a skier cross event, and it was actually wicked fun. So I don't know. Maybe it's a boring answer. I don't know what he was asking about.
Do you got any old cyber gear left around?
I got a whole bin. got a whole bin in my basement. Some of the stuff is still like in like the plastic bags that they ship them in.
Are you selling it for the people that want it?
I don't know.
Well,
if I have enough extra, I don't have a ton of it. Some of it I got rid of. I have given some stuff to Balls too, because that guy is a diehard fan. So I've given him some stuff fast. I think I have some stuff either I need to send him, or maybe I have just recently sent him some stuff. But he's big into it.
Levin Studio joint. Is that Dave Levin? That'd be fun. Video with everyone running old gear would be so good.
That's right, Kutcher. Kutch Master on the fucking program.
Just a big old get-together would be good, too.
Yeah, that would be fun to see people in real life. I always wonder how rich I'd have to be to like pay for everyone to come see with families. That'd be crazy. Otherwise than that, it seems almost impossible globally.
Some of the best days skiing were like later X Games. I think there was like a 10-year run where I hadn't gone back to an X Games because of the trade show out in Vegas, like SIA trade show. And there was a couple years in a row that like I would leave the show a couple of days early and then go over to the X Games and check that out. And some of those days where it was like contests were over, but then all these old ski dudes would just get together and have some beers and then just go charge the mountain together and just ski fast at Aspen was awesome. Those were some of the best days ever. There'd be like 30 dudes just hammering down, scary, like literally scary, because you think people are going to ramp into you and you're going to die because everybody's just skiing so fast. Those are some of the best days, just like for no reason other than just to go ski. I don't know. Things are coming back into my head now.
Yeah, memories. That's why we have to talk longer than the hour that we try to allocate for this, because realistically we could go a whole day or two or three.
Yeah.
Fuck, you guys, man. It's been a while.
Let's see if you remember the last comp and how, and did you feel like the comp days were over when it snuck up on you, the last competition? This is Skis Baller asking.
I kind of knew it was going to come to an end, I guess. I think maybe one of the last contests I did was potentially that TELUS World Ski and Snowboard Fest where I did that zero spin, or maybe it was one of the core games over in Japan. Remember those things, the core games?
Did you retire then? I never thought about it, but like when I think about it now, like you kind of went full business out of nowhere.
Well, the year of Stereotype, I think you must have got like those World Ski and Snowboard Fest. You got those shots.
Yeah, right there.
And then we filmed the whole, because I think the last winter that we filmed most of that stuff, I wasn't competing. But that may have been one of the last contest shots.
Wicked. Well, that's a fucking dope-ass way to go out.
Yeah, buddy. That may have been one of the last ones. That was a sick event, man. That whole place was jam-packed down near the Longhorn, down at the bottom of whatever Whistler, Blackcomb base area. There's people like hanging out of their hotel rooms. That event was awesome. That thing was big time.
It was. This one could be fun. Biggest contract for an Araj athlete. You're not on contract with them anymore. I'd like to know who had it in your time period there and how much.
Probably TJ Schiller. That dude pulled some cash. Like, I don't know. I don't know if I should really give numbers.
Is it six plus figures?
He was in that zone, man.
Big up yourself, TJ Schiller. He was a bomb fucking late 2000s.
Yeah, and it may have been after that year that he threw that 1440 for the first time ever in maybe the X Games. I don't know.
US Open he won in 2004.
Yeah. I wasn't managing TJ's contract. I got paid. And Araj back in the day was spending some money on athletes. They were definitely supporting those. That's for sure.
Fuck yeah, TJ. That's for sure,
yeah. Still my highest paid contract to this day.
Really?
I guess with the conversion of money in U.S., it would be equivalent these days, I think. But, yeah, basically, yeah.
Yeah, those guys. And then there was, like, one year when it just kind of, like, came to an end. But, yeah, those guys were paying some athletes.
Chat about you and Steve working and Turpin working out that C-Rail in Utah for way too long until you tapped into the dollar bill, yo.
So I think Turpin had put like 100 tries in on that thing or something silly. Like,
we went three. I remember this too. I can add to it. We went three different days, and each time we had over 100 tries minimum. Continue.
Yeah. And I mean, whatever. It was probably luck of the draw, because you don't just drop into a rail like that and get it that fast. Especially Turpin's good, dude. If he hadn't gotten it after 200-300 tries, but I think I did it on my fourth.
And here was the worst part about it as the filmmaker. So I said, okay, like, this is gnarly. I said, once you, we'll shoot it on digi, and once you get it on digital, we'll shoot film. So Mike got it super early. We got the digital shot, and then we burned, like, I think I burned 4 rolls of film on that rail, and no one got it, and I just threw the film in the garbage when I went home.
Yeah, but did I have to do it again? Did I get it again?
No, you didn't. You no.
And I think it was Fred Foto put a $100 bill on the end of that thing. He's like, whoever hits the end of this thing is getting that $100 bill.
And Fred Foto had multiple dogs on the scene while he took little bong.
Tormented Turpin for a long time.
That was awesome.
Good stuff. Hell yeah, Mike. We gotta wrap this up. Man. Keep it to the hour and a half period that we got, but just want to give thanks from the whole skiing culture, if I may, to the contribution that you brought to the table, from the many facets that you operated, from trick pioneering to brand strategist and entrepreneur. You're just like a gem to skiing, and we want to take this time to give you your flowers respectfully.
Yeah, man. Give thanks, Mike. Fucking, I know all this shit you did. Stoked I got to work with you. Stoked I got to watch what you do. Stoked to watch what you made happen. So just big up yourself. If you don't know Mike Nick, he made probably some of your dreams happen that are watching that don't know him.
Yeah. Hey, honestly, thanks to you guys, because without you guys doing stuff like this, it's like guys like me kind of just fade away, and it's been sort of nice fading away, because now I just go skiing with my kids and we just go free ride at the mountain and we just tailgate and have beers and hot dogs and grill out on a ski day. And it's just like something that you do just for the fun of it now. There's like no pressure. There's no business behind it. There's none of that. But there's a lot of good memories, man, that came out of that whole era. And so guys like you, Phil, keep that torch alive, man, because you're doing amazing things with it, and watching you and how you have progressed the whole sport is literally mind-blowing at times. And just to have a chat with you guys and kind of be recognized is a pretty, pretty awesome thing. So thanks, boys.
Hell yeah, Mike Nixon.
All right, fellas.
Thank you, Mike.
Hey.
Peace, brother.
Yeah, have a good later. Day, man. Take care.
Yes, people, we've done it on this 420 holiday. Eric Eiberg's birthday session. He got two, so he aged 2 years per year. So,
got a birthday every day.
Anybody unfamiliar with what we just did, we got this weekly tradition of giving flowers to some legends in the sport, people that shaped the whole culture in their own way and did things differently and left their stain upon the culture, but sometimes the stain's been erased by some type of entity, who knows what it is. But so next week, who we got on?
Philou. We got Philou Poirier. Fuck yeah, Philou. I'm pretty stoked. So you may know him from switchback flips. You know, may know him from being really, really tall. What else do we know him from? Just awesomeness. Philou, I'm so stoked if you're even watching. But if you're not, we'll talk to you next week. Whoever's here and listening to us at our 1 hour, 40 minutes, Philou, next week, it's going to be amazing.
Yeah. And for people here also, check out Inspired Paws, about to take over the whole pet industry with some CBD products. Please feed your cats the right stuff and check them out, because Iberg's going to put some cats on the fucking pedestal and create some superstars.
Super cats, man. Stars. There'll be more next week. We'll talk about it. Coming soon on Inspired Stuff. So we got Philou next week. Check out fucking Phil's stuff. Phil's working on his cartoon. What's the name of your cartoon?
Yo, it's ever changing. Right now it's The Lost Crystal.
But you can see what he's working on. These are some of the characters. You can go to his link in his Instagram page. That's got some trailers that he's working on. It's ever evolving, ever growing. So you can see, watch that, see what's up, possibly help if possible. And yeah, I guess that's it, man. I guess next week we talking skiing again. 1:30 p.m. East Coast time.
Booyah. Much love, y'all. Thanks, Rick.
Yeah, man. Thanks, man. Have a great day. Peace.